morning, UConn, and welcome to Husky Nation News, right here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. The broadcast today is in collaboration with the UConn newspaper, The Daily Campus, and UConn's TV station, UCTV. I'm your host, Caroline LaCour, and here's the news of the week for the University of Connecticut. Five dorms are in quarantine after UConn sees its highest spike of cases in a single day at UConn Stores campus Wednesday. After an email was sent out by the Associate Vice President and Dean of Students, Eleanor Daugherty, students residing in Belden, Batterson, Tolland, Middlesex, and Worth Halls are being required to quarantine after a spike of 11 on-campus and 23 off-campus positive test results were reported. Students who are instructed to quarantine must only use takeout dining from designated dining halls, not attend in-person classes or activities, and are required to take a COVID-19 surveillance test. Daugherty ended the email with a warning message to the UConn community on the dangers of a lackadaisical attitude towards the virus. Quote, "It is of critical importance that we stay strong, stay connected, and continue to care for the health and safety of others on campus." Election officials have announced Joseph R. Biden Jr. as the 46th President of the United States on Saturday after a grueling election week. The Trump campaign still has yet to concede as they file lawsuits in multiple battleground states over various elements of the voting process. Election officials have not yet proved any mishandling or fraud that would have played a role in the election, costing the Trump campaign a victory. Biden already commented on Trump and his campaign's behavior as an embarrassment and says, quote, "It does not in any way change the dynamic of what we're able to do." Biden and his team also unveiled in a press conference Monday morning a group of public health experts to make up a coronavirus advisory board, where Biden also left a determined comment on his upcoming plans despite the Trump campaign's hesitation for a smooth transition. Quote, "We're going to be moving along in a consistent manner, putting together our administration within the White House and reviewing who we're going to pick for the cabinet positions," said Biden. "And nothing's going to stop that." Students residing at the University of Connecticut's Storrs campus and most of the state of Connecticut felt the ground rumble Sunday after a magnitude 3.6 earthquake reverberated from Massachusetts to Connecticut. Michael Thompson of the Daily Campus reports that seismographic data from the Department of Geosciences shows that the earthquake happened in the early morning around 9 a.m. and lasted almost 5 minutes. Kristen LaBlanca, a seventh semester student, said she hardly ever hears about natural disasters happening in New England, which is why the earthquake was so surprising for her and many other students. Quote, "I feel like it's very crazy to hear, especially in Connecticut where nothing naturally bad ever happens here except for hurricanes," LaBlanca said. "I'm glad everyone is safe. I'm shocked to hear that there was an earthquake." Summer Dawn Reyes of the In Full Color organization hosted the Poetry as Activism writing workshop with the Women's Center on Monday. Sarah Goodman of the Daily Campus reports attendees explored using words to describe their feelings about activism, which they then used to create their own slant poetry. In Full Color is an organization that seeks to empower artistic women of color while also informing the public of issues that affect all women of color. In Full Color's repertoire features numerous artistic ventures outside of writing workshops, including hosting poetry readings, publishing zines, and even performance activism. Holiday season is officially here, which means that the Starbucks holiday drinks are back. Olivia Hickey of the Daily Campus reports that, like years prior, Starbucks has brought back some of their classic drinks, including a peppermint mocha and a caramel brulee latte for the holiday season. A fan favorite, the peppermint mocha is, quote, "a delectable blend of chocolate pepperminty perfection and every cool sip. Frappuccino roast coffee, mocha sauce, peppermint flavored syrup, milk and ice topped with whipped cream and dark chocolate curls," according to Starbucks' website, is how the drink is made. As well, participating Starbucks are offering their annual holiday reusable cup. This year's cup is red with ribbon decor printed on the cup, similar to a design of a holiday sweater. Despite changes due to the coronavirus pandemic, the 2021 Tennis Grand Slams will likely continue with the bubble concept and limited capacity. Nicholas Hellenhazen has the story.
With the COVID-19 pandemic still looming over the world, the 2021 Tennis Grand Slams will likely continue with the bubble concept and limited capacity. During 2020, three of the four Grand Slams were able to take place. Wimbledon was cancelled for the first time since 1945. The Australian Open took place in January before the pandemic erupted, allowing the tournament to proceed as usual. The French and US Opens were forced to alter the structure of their events to make a 2020 edition of the tournament possible. The US Open was staged during its usual time, at the end of August into the beginning of September. To limit the number of people on the grounds, the United States Tennis Association prohibited fans from attending the tournament, cut down the number of teams in the doubles draws, and canceled the qualifying stages. The tournament also required that players stay at either the Long Island Marriott in Uniondale, the Garden City Hotel, or in some instances, rent a private house during their stay in New York. The rule was enforced to limit players' contact with the general public. Players had to undergo frequent COVID-19 testing and were limited to bringing 3 team members with them on the premises. If a player broke any protocols, tested positive for the COVID-19 virus, or was in contact with someone who tested positive, they would be withdrawn from the tournament immediately. This was the case when the top-seeded women's doubles pair, Kristina Mladenovic and Tamaya Babos, were withdrawn from their second-round encounter after Mladenovic played cards one night with Benoit Paire, who had tested positive for the virus. The French Open took place shortly after the U.S. Open, with the qualifying rounds starting on September 21st. The French Open had to move their typical start date, which is at the end of May, because of the pandemic. This marked the first time that the French Open took place in the fall and presented players with tons of new challenges. Players had to battle gusts of wind, 50-degree temperatures, heavy tennis balls, slow court speeds, and several rain delays. In order to keep the players safe, the French Open adopted the same procedures as the U.S. Open for withdrawing players who were exposed to the virus. Also like the U.S. Open, players were required to stay in one of 2 designated hotels, but the players would not have the hotels to themselves as they did in New York. Fans were allowed to attend the French Open, but the grounds had a limited capacity of 1,000 people per day. The majority of players expressed how the conditions were much better at the bubble in New York than the one in Paris. Players said they appreciated how the USTA set up different activities for the players across the tournament grounds. The US Open premises were filled with pool tables, basketball nets, ping pong tables, an arcade room, and seated players were provided their own suite inside of Arthur Ashe Stadium. The USTA even provided players with several dining options and amenities at the hotels they were staying at. In Paris, on the other hand, the athletes described their hotels as crammed with little accommodations. Players expressed concern about the levels of social distancing that were taking place at both the tournament and hotel. With a lot of uncertainty still surrounding the state of the COVID-19 virus, Grand Slam officials are planning a variety of scenarios for the 2021 editions of their tournaments. Tournament directors are hoping to let as many fans as possible onto the grounds next year and cut back on the restrictions placed on the players. The Australian Open, which is the first Grand Slam of the year, already announced that it is confident that the tournament will take place, but officials are still ironing out all the details of the event. From WHUS News, this is Nicholas Hellinghausen. Have a great one.
Weather for the next few days for the Storrs Mansfield area looks a little gray, with a 40% chance of showers and patchy fog on Thursday, a high of 59 and a low of 52, and a 60% chance of rain on Friday, with a high of 49, low of 36. Your rain boots have their work still cut out for them for this weekend, while your snow pants are safe in your closet for yet another week. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, this is Elvis Costello, and you're listening to WHUS.
From this point forward, the views and opinions expressed on this WHUS News Department show are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily the views of the staff, management, or licensees of WHUS Radio or of the University of Connecticut.
I'm going to put it in the middle. We're going to see how that goes. I don't know.
It usually works out pretty well.
Yeah. So it is I, Caroline McCourt, and we have here multimedia journalist, student journalist Alex Leo with us. We are currently sitting on the UConn North tennis courts. It is currently 7:13 on a Tuesday. We had no other good place to... You know what? No, this it was a choice to sit down on this tennis court.
It's nice out. I'm not complaining.
It was an artistic choice. The reason why I chose Alex to sit down and talk with today... We're both journalism majors here at UConn, and I just wanted to have like a conversation on the importance of journalism. We probably have a lot of listeners, but a lot of people probably don't understand what goes behind making a story, especially in today's political climate with
the coronavirus. It's a very relevant topic now.
Yeah. Could you tell the listeners, like, who you are, like, what your story is, like, where you're from?
Well, I'm from a town in Connecticut that no one's ever heard of called Weston. It's near Fairfield, Westport, 45 minutes away from Bridgeport, just to give people some reference. Nothing in Weston. Everybody goes to the other towns. It's part of Connecticut that's like a lot of other Connecticut's, just farmland, but it really has that small town feel. And I chose journalism because probably one of the biggest heroes I have is Anthony Bourdain. And he is most notably a cook and traveler, but he's also a journalist. He writes wherever he went. And I also saw it as, it was kind of the time when, I think, well, 2016, I guess, really solidified things for me as well as a lot of other people, but especially for journalism.
Yeah.
Because one of the key parts of journalism is keeping powerful people in check, and that's become very more important.
Become very prominent.
And very more important to do, especially now. It's not just something that comes in a big headline that surprises people. It's something that has to happen every day, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And for the past year, we've literally had something very surprising in the news every day.
It's been an interesting year for everyone, for sure. Not even just journalists.
Yeah.
So tell me how you got into like photography and such. When did that first start?
The start of that story is unfortunately not that interesting, but it gets more interesting as we get to the present. But I wanted to just take photos so I could preserve memories in a like high quality format. But after, well, most of the stuff we did in our photo class was just like, it's a photo class, so it's an art class. I learned that, I guess, a memory could be in any type of photo. Even if you're taking, let's say, like fashion photography, or you're going for a hike, you're doing a shoot, just some sort of creative thing with a friend, that's still a memory, or at least that's how I see it. Many of my friends, especially my best friend back at home, we do tons of shoots. He's probably the person I shoot with most. But I'll look through those photos like anyone else would look through a scrapbook. I will take a couple pictures at concerts with my phone.
Yeah.
Not because I'm going to share them online or anything like that. I'm not too active with that type of stuff, but it's just so...
have the memory.
Exactly. And it's not like I have my camera there, and I usually take a couple photos sometimes without looking, take like a 5-10 second video of a song, just so I can... Every concert sounds different. You don't go to a concert for quality, so you go to the concert for that band at that moment. So I kind of like to have a little reference to it, but yeah, it's for the memories. That's definitely the main point.
So you started with photography just to... almost as a hobby.
To capture
memories, of course, as everyone does.
Yeah.
I feel like nowadays with iPhones and everything, everyone's a pretend, like, photographer, you know?
Yeah.
And how did this cross over to Anthony Bourdain and wanting to be a journalism major? When did that first start?
When did I realize that maybe he inspired me? Or
yeah, that, and also when did you realize that you could use this photography to capture stories and such? And why did you decide to bridge the gap between hobby and more like work, you know?
I think it more became, I guess, cooking's another hobby of mine, but like that, and photography just became something I really enjoy doing. It's less of a... I wouldn't say it's a hobby, I would say it's more of a passion, and then I guess kind of a job, I think it should be one and the same, because if you don't have a job that you're passionate about, you're probably not going to enjoy working there.
That's a good point.
But one of the best ways we have to like look back at history is by looking at famous photos, regardless of if they're technically called news photos. All the photos you see of World War II or of people in the 1800s, they're more or less all taken from news photographers, people who were assigned to, let's say, take some of the pictures on the D-Day landing. Like, one of the most famous photographers who has taken a lot of photos of a lot of gruesome historical scenes was, and I'm not going to remember his name, so I'm not going to try to remember that, but he's taken a lot of photos of, most notably, there's a man, the moment after he was shot in maybe the Spanish-American War. But anyway, he got that famous photo. And sometimes these type of photos are some of the only ways people can truly know something's happening. Or it can give you a different image or a different perspective on how something's happening. Good photo I could reference was when, during the campaign season, Trump advertises himself as the picture of America that everything's always okay. We're around the corner with the coronavirus, we've defeated ISIS, it's all about happy things. But when he came back from that Tulsa rally that was severely undersold and unbiasedly considered a failure, There's a picture of him with his tie undone, looking completely wiped out, walking out from the helicopter. And like, that was the mood of the rally. That is his mood. It shows that he's more human than he likes to give off.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, especially now, I feel like this is getting, you take photos for the Daily Campus, as the people may or may not know. I don't believe you, have you written any articles yet, or no?
I haven't. I've thought about maybe even writing a couple opinion articles, but
photojournalism is more of your
Yeah, and a lot of photojournalists write articles, probably a good amount of them do, and a photojournalist is also going to take a lot of video. A lot of times they take on all three. I think it's mainly just because of the work. If I had a bit more time, I'd probably write some articles. And I think I wanted to focus more on the photo aspect of it, but it was mainly a time constraint.
What I'm trying to get at is, I mean, we've also taken pretty much the same amount of class. We've had the same classes multiple times.
Yeah, pretty much.
What I'm trying to say is people might not notice that, like, photojournalists aren't any less of, like, a journalist. Like, you still have the same, like, we learn the same things in class. We have the same, we're taking the same journalism ethics class.
Yeah, it's...
So you know what you're doing. We're both student journalists.
Of course, yeah.
What I want to say is I feel like now at this very high energy, I don't know if it's a positive or a negative energy. I still have to feel out for
it. It's a little of both.
A little of both. Of
a lot of both.
The Associated Press declaring Joe Biden as the winner as the 46th president this past weekend, I believe. I feel a lot of Trump supporters believe that when Trump was president, journalists were too hard on him.
Well, he said that he was treated worse than any other president, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think that
not to mention JFK?
Do you think that journalists were too hard on President Trump and aren't going to be hard on Biden?
I don't think they were hard enough, to be honest. I think there were multiple times where they let him get away without saying things that he should have said, or they didn't ask probing questions that I thought they could have. Because when we were all at home, my dad and I had the addictive habit of watching Trump's coronavirus press briefings, which he said that they were campaign rallies, which in hindsight they were.
Yeah.
But every time we would say, like, why didn't you ask this? Or why aren't you follow-ups? Or sometimes people would kind of let him slip off. And you can't let him slip off, because if you don't ask that question now, you can't fully hold him accountable. And Trump's the kind of person who would always try to, of course, dodge the blame. And even if they caught him in the act, you could still expect the same. But with any important person, if you have them on the record saying something, you can call them out on it later. Not that that's the point, but you have that ability.
Yeah.
They're automatically held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should be just as hard as on Biden. They should be just as hard on anybody else.
I feel like the problem is a lot of people...
I think people are going to think they'll treat him better, but...
I think it's just
his attitude.
Yeah.
Everybody's seen the way that Trump snapped at reporters.
Yeah.
It's not like that's any surprise. Politicians evade questions all the time, and the press has always kind of been seen as a little skeevy in the eyes of politics, but a lot of times that's also because people don't hear what they want to hear.
As a student journalist, and I mean essentially as a journalist, what do you think of the weight behind the whole fake news push and trend currently in America?
Like that it's happening more?
That it's happening more. The narrative that the media is all trying to make people look bad, or it's all about...
It's pretty bad because there's a lot of there's a growing general distrust with the media, and the media is also a term I'm kind of kicking myself for using and I don't like using, because the media refers to literally anything. Everywhere you get media, which is movies, social media, it could be an advertisement. The media, if you're going to talk about the press, journalism, there's specifics to that, but there has been more fake news, not really by the people that we get our news from, but there's been a lot of manufactured fake news. There's been a lot of fake news made by people who make it look like these popular publications are publishing news, but they're not. Or news is continuously being absorbed from social media, so the definition of news is changing. But there's also just a general distrust with the news, and that's since Trump has taken office, there's been I think the New York Times did a project where they charted the amount of times that fake news was used in tweets by Trump and by other people on social media ever since he got elected until I think it was last year, but there has been a hugely significant increase, and we know that he only that Trump likes certain what he calls real news network and not fake news, which the fake news he's called CNN, New York Times, anyone that's really given him a bad rap, and he's even kind of lost the favor of Fox News, or maybe they've lost the favor of him, but he's been cozying up to another news network that is strictly conservative news, and there's even a new it's not seen as competition yet, but there's another platform that's starting to rival Twitter that's, again, strictly conservative news.
I haven't heard that.
It's very new. There's a couple political figures on it that are pretty notable, like Ted Cruz is on it, some other people that you would recognize, but the main premise of the app is that it's all about free speech. It's all about all the stuff that Twitter and Facebook are taking down, which has been a clamp on fake news. So the push to take down fake news, I was thinking about this last night and the night before, it could drive the news that is considered fake news potentially more underground if it's not taken care of. The very point about taking down the fake news, or the very ability that the platforms have to take down the fake news, is because it's a platform. They're not news. They're just relaying. It's a forum for people to post their opinions. Yeah. So that's the point. It has to be unbiased.
It's the danger between reporting something and then reporting an opinion and not labeling it opinion, I feel.
I mean, you can have the same charisma or following as a news agency, like a political figure does, but you have all the assumed authority, but without any of the evidence. It's like the voter fraud.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no evidence to this, but somehow a lot of the country still thinks that there are fraudulent votes, and it's stalling the process of it's stalling a constitutional process. There's a lot of hypocrisy on this from people who are supposed to be keeping that in check.
Yeah.
And without reporting, we wouldn't know that. That's why we read the articles. That's exactly how we know this stuff happens.
It is interesting how I've definitely noticed a turn with a lot of news organizations, honestly fairly recently, how they have been transparent with their reporting in order to combat this quote-unquote fake news. Every article or every debate or press conference that goes out, the New York Times and the Washington Post, they have started reporting like fact checks.
Honestly, ever since 2016, when people it started to become more apparent that things were just not true in certain speeches, but certain places like Politico and I guess Snopes, maybe sites like that, have been doing that stuff for years, but the New York Times especially, and places like NPR and the BBC, after debates and a lot of big publicized events like that, because that's where unfortunately a lot of people only tune into that because it's more exciting and it's all about the show. Yeah. But there's no fact checking in it. It's not an article, there's no there's less of a higher standard for, I guess, telling the truth. And this has become almost like a check on the speeches.
Yeah. Do you think maybe this is the new normal for journalists? Or do you think this is more of a temporary thing?
I would say it probably should be the new normal. I think it's always good to know. I think we know now how many people actually tune in to televised events, and that the last presidential debates were some of the most watched events in American history. It makes you think why people pay so much to get ads at the Super Bowl. It's because everybody's watching it. I think it's just another check. I don't see any downside to it. Again, like, a journalist's job is not to make somebody feel good, and
we're not PR.
Exactly. Yeah, we're not PR. PR's job is strictly damage control. But
it's a middle ground.
This is damage control for free thought and expression. I mean, yeah. it's damage control for the listener, because there's no filter. If done right, journalism's a filter.
To end on a light note, I saw this meme. Is meme the right word? A funny photo.
No. Meme's a perfectly acceptable term.
It's
in the dictionary.
Of a bunch of soups. And my final question to you is, what is your favorite soup? Would you like to see the photo, or do you have one in mind?
I like cooking a lot of soups at home. Gazpacho is always nice.
Yeah. Gazpacho? Cold?
Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be less enjoyable in a couple months, but I don't think I have a favorite soup.
Don't have a favorite soup?
I don't. No, I don't.
Not like a comfort soup, like when you're feeling like sick or something?
No. No.
Too much to choose from.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't pick a favorite for many things. I enjoy a lot of food.
Okay, there you have it, folks. Thanks, Alex, for coming onto the show.
Thanks for joining us on Husky Nation News. We'd like to give a thank you to the Daily Campus and to UCTV for collaborating with us, as well as to Ethan Smith for making our theme music. You've been listening to WHUS Stores on 91.7 FM. I'm Caroline the Core. Have a great one.